Round this morning, we're lucky to have Jean-Luc Lerners from Princeton Center for Theoretical Science visiting us. He's going to tell us about observing the multi-field cyclic universe.
Thanks very much. It's a great pleasure to be here, and thank you for attending second talk in a row, and missing out on lunch and all this. I'm going to talk about some recent progress in the most recent developments in the cyclic universe. But let me just start with some very sort of general remarks. So, of course, in cosmology, what we'd like to understand is sort of the state of the universe at very early times, in some sense, the initial conditions for the universe. Now, one famous problem is that we know that the universe is very flat today, and we know that curvature, the relative energy density in curvature scales, is 1/ah², where a is the scale factor and h the Hubble parameter. So if you just extrapolate back to the Planck time, we know that the curvature must have been extremely small, and this is one of the puzzles we'd like to understand. Now, the standard solution to this problem that's assumed and that has been proposed by Alan Guth quite a while ago is an early period of exponential expansion, accelerated expansion. During this time, the Hubble parameter is roughly constant while A grows exponentially. So you can see that the curvature term gets driven to very small values. And if this period of inflation lasts long enough, you solve the flatness problem. And as you all know, you can model this by having a scalar field in a theory with a flat and positive potential. And the most important byproduct of this theory is that if you now treat this semi-classically, you find that you produce a nearly scale-invariant spectrum of scalar and tensor perturbations, of which scalar perturbations have been observed and tensor perturbations not yet. And so this is, those are the very sort of promising features of inflation. Right? However, let me point out some open problems. I mean, this is not a complete list. This is just a personal choice of open problems that I think are serious enough to actually to prompt us to look for alternatives too. The first concern is just an aesthetic one. It has recently become possible to actually try and construct derived inflationary models in string theory. I would argue that these models are certainly not looking very natural. So it is possible to have inflation in string theory. We now know that, subject to certain assumptions. Typically, you get many contributions to an effective potential, and you have to really fine-tune parameters quite carefully to find some region of the potential that is just flat enough so that you can have inflation occurring. So it's certainly not something that comes out in a very natural way. It seems to me that perhaps if string theory had been known earlier, you would not necessarily have thought of an inflationary solution to the problems of the early universe. A more serious problem is the problem of initial conditions. So the idea of inflation is to actually try and resolve this problem, but I would argue that really it only partly solves it. So it is known, for example, that inflation only starts if you have a reasonably large region of space that's reasonably homogeneous, and the scalar field needs to have a reasonably small initial velocity, otherwise you just don't get inflation. So these are normally called the patch and overshoot problems. Moreover, in the context of eternal inflation, the idea is that you have a whole landscape of possible vacua, and the idea is that eternal inflation will populate all of these. There's been some very recent work by Aguirre and Johnson and Lafort showing that once you include dynamics, this might not actually be the case anymore. That, for example, you might nucleate bubbles of with a lower cosmological constant, but that the energy of the bubble wall can be sufficient that even though you thought you had a stable vacuum where, for example, the volume of the internal dimension was stabilized in some kind of potential, it turns out that in many cases, perhaps the energy in the bubble wall is enough to destabilize that volume modulus. So actually, once you try and tunnel to this new vacuum, what you get is a space-time that decompactifies to 10 dimensions. This has furthermore the implication that you might have certain regions of the landscape where you just decompactify and you can't go any further, so that you don't actually populate the whole landscape, which adds to the problem of initial conditions, because then you need to decide why you started in that region of the landscape which gave you our vacuum. Furthermore, there is the problem. There is another issue in inflation, which is that inflation is geodesically past incomplete, and so you are forced to fix initial conditions at some point in the past. And inflation has memory of this. So in that sense, you need to really, inflation is not enough by itself, but you need to add additional information. And this is sort of unexplained at the moment. Another very serious problem is the problem of unpredictability, which is that eternal inflation really makes infinite numbers of universes of all sorts. So infinite numbers of universes that are flat and infinite numbers of universes that are not flat. So without any measure, you don't know what you're actually predicting. So in that sense, I would really argue that inflation by itself is an incomplete theory. And if it turns out that inflation gets further support from observations, for example, if the tensor spectrum is observed, then these are problems that really will have to be addressed. So in this talk, I want to talk about a different framework, which arises from a very surprising realization that if you have a slowly contracting phase of the universe, you can solve the same cosmological puzzles as in an accelerating, expanding universe. This goes by the name of the ekphorotic phase, this slowly contracting phase. And during this phase, even though the universe is contracting, it's contracting very slowly so that the scale factor is almost constant, while the Hubble parameter grows rapidly. So you can see again that the curvature term, for example, is driven to extremely small values. And if this ekphorotic phase lasts long enough, you solve the flatness problem. In some sense, this is the dual solution to what you had in inflation, where h was constant and a was growing fast. You can model this with the scalar field again, but this time you need a potential that is steep and negative as opposed to flat and positive. So it's really sort of the opposite. This steep potential has the consequence that the equation of state is very large. So this is a phase of having with a very large pressure to energy density ratio. And if you define an epsilon parameter, which you can define in the same way as for inflation, so in inflation, this would be the slow roll parameter and would roughly be of order 1 over 100. In this case, you find that with the same definition, this comes out as the c squared over 2, where c is sort of the coefficient in a toy model potential, where it's just an exponential. And in this case, epsilon is rather a fast roll parameter and tends to be of order 100. Now, as soon as you have a contracting phase of the universe, and we know that we're currently in an expanding phase, you can wonder whether it's possible to have these phases in succession and make extend this model to having a cyclic picture. This is the model that was proposed by Neil and Paul Steinert, and the idea is that we currently live in a dark energy phase. At a small positive value of the potential, and that if this phase is followed by the ekphorotic potential, as soon as the potential goes to negative values, the universe starts contracting, and you enter an ekphorotic phase where the equation of state starts growing and becomes very large. Eventually, this potential drops off, goes to zero, and you arrive at the big crunch. And then if you assume that you can have a bounce and go through this big crunch, big bang transition, you can bounce back again to the sort of positive part, the positive plateau of the potential, where then this subsequently you have the standard periods of radiation, matter, and again, dark energy domination. So there is actually there is an alternative higher dimensional picture in which to view this, where this field is where you take the brain world view of space-time, and this scalar field here corresponds to what determines the distance between the brains So over on the left, as the field goes to minus infinity, that would correspond to the brains colliding, whereas on the right, we have the brains at an almost constant distance right now during the dark energy phase. Now, one very attractive feature of this is that this solution is actually, the single field cyclic solution is actually a dynamical attractor. And so you can dynamically set up initial conditions during each cycle for the next cycle. And in this sense, you get a solution to the problem of initial conditions. There is one issue with this single field model, which has to do with the cosmological perturbations that you create. So if you just look at a scalar field with a negative potential, you don't consider gravity, and you calculate the spectrum, you find out that this scalar field has a nearly scale invariant spectrum of perturbation. Now, surprisingly, once you add gravity, it turns out that the curvature perturbation that you produce has actually a blue spectrum disagrees with observations. It turns out that the Newtonian potential does have a scale invariant spectrum, but the curvature perturbation doesn't. For inflation, these two quantities pick up the same spectrum, but in a contracting universe, it turns out that they are really separate modes. There are various suggestions for how to overcome this problem. One suggestion is that, well, close to the bounds, it seems possible that these two modes, the Newtonian potential and the curvature perturbations, could somehow mix. This is not possible in a four-dimensional theory, but in a higher dimensional context, this seems like a possibility. Now, a second possibility for actually getting a scale invariant spectrum in a contracting phase is a mechanism recently proposed by Justin Curry and Paul Seinert, where you have a very rapidly increasing equation of state. However, it's at the moment it looks very difficult to actually incorporate this mechanism into a cyclic picture, because you start at a positive value of the potential, but assume that you are already in a contracting phase of the universe. So this mechanism at face value doesn't seem to be compatible with a cyclic picture. But this is something that hasn't been explored there really. And a third possibility, which is what I'm going to talk about here, is that, well, it might be that this theory is really not not complete, in the sense that typically when we try and look at models of at any solutions in string theory, we typically have many more fields around. And it turns out that, for example, if you try and embed the cyclic model in supergravity, or in 11-dimensional supergravity, which is its natural framework, the geometrical picture is that you have a brain world with the M-theory dimension being the dimension that goes in between the two brains, but on top of that, there is an internal Calabi-Yau manifold. And so, at the very least, you always have two scalar fields in four-dimensional effective theory, one determining the distance between the brains, and the other one the volume of the internal Calabi-Yau manifold. Of course, you can typically have many more moduli which determine the shape of the Calabi-Yau manifold, but you always have these two universal scalars. And it turns out that this simple extension to having more than one scalar field has quite important consequences in the context of the cyclic universe. So it doesn't just change the model quantitatively, but it really has qualitative differences. And that's what I'm going to talk about. So just as a simple illustration of this point, if you consider these two scalar fields to pick up ekpyrotic potentials, so you have two scalar fields with two steeply falling potentials. If you picture this, and you can see that you can make a rotation in field space and re-express this as having one scalar field with a potential that is steeply falling in this direction, in this which I call the sigma direction, which is the adiabatic direction. But the transverse direction now actually has an unstable tachyonic potential. It falls off on both sides. So an immediate consequence of having more than one scalar field in an ekpyrotic solution is that you start having an instability. In other words, this nice attractor behavior that you had in the single field cyclic model is gone. And you need to address, well, and it becomes a bit of a puzzle at first sight how you can actually make a cyclic universe in this framework. Yeah.
Is the form of this motivated from supergravity, or
the potential at this point is just evident. Just
that hard. So yeah. Why don't you consider a potential which is rapidly falling in one direction but stable, has some positive mass squared in the transverse direction?
Well, because it turns out that this potential has actually very nice features.
And that doesn't.
The one, the stable one, yeah. Doesn't. No. So if you have the stable one, you have the same problem that you had before, that you, the scalar perturbations which you produce have a blue spectrum.
Okay.
It turns out that this potential has the specific property that you actually make scale invariant perturbations, and I'm going to talk about that in a minute.
So what is the picture in the bulk? So earlier we had like two brains and
Brains which are, and you assume that there is an attractive force between them.
But earlier the field which we had was a modulus between two brains.
Yes.
And now what is the interpretation of the second field?
So the two fields, one is the distance between the brains, the other one is the volume of the Calabi-Yau manifold. But it turns out that the fields which I'm considering here, which I'm calling phi 1 and phi 2, are both functions of the two scalar fields. So it's, you can make a field redefinition and into these fields phi 1 and phi 2, which are canonically normalized. And that's an easier way to analyze this. So by assuming potentials for these two fields, I'm assuming that the two original fields also both get potential. So let's analyze in a bit more detail what happens if you have a contracting phase in the presence of such a potential. So typically what will be the case for most regions of space-time, they will be that they correspond to trajectories which are not exactly on this ridge, but slightly off. So I should say that the motion
along this ridge is what corresponds to the ekparotic solution. So if you are slightly off the ridge, you will actually fall off to the side. Right? The consequence is that those regions of space-time don't actually undergo a full ekparotic phase, so they don't get flattened sufficiently, and in the approach to the big crunch, these regions will develop large curvatures, will undergo chaotic mixmaster collapse, and presumably end up in some collapsed state, consisting of black holes, presumably. The main point is that those regions of space-time really start, they collapse and they stop growing and stop cycling. So they sort of disconnect from the evolution of the universe. On the other hand, now, if we consider the regions of space-time which correspond to being extremely close to this ridge,
the other direction, don't all of them go to minus infinity?
Well, I'm not showing the full picture. It turns out that only if you go along this direction do you actually, in the high dimensional picture, that's the only direction that corresponds to the Calabi-Yau volume and the brain scale factors being staying at the going towards a finite, non-zero value at the big crunch. If you go, all the other directions correspond to the Calabi-Yau volume either shrinking to zero or blowing up. And if it blows up, it turns out that then the brain shrinks to zero. So all the other directions correspond to reaching a really singular sort of Kasner-type mixmaster collapse.
But, there are situations where coupling can just vanish and you don't have to worry about it. You know, things blowing up, right?
I'm sorry, the situations where...
Well, in the heterodimensional picture, the coupling will go to zero sometimes when it goes to the single region.
Well, the coupling goes to zero, but the problem is you already start building up large curvatures long before. So those regions which are close to the ridge will undergo the full ekparotic phase. And so in the higher dimensional picture, this means that the brains become
extremely flat and parallel close to the crunch. The space-time becomes really Milne space, and so all curvatures are very small. And the expectation is that this is a mild singularity that you can actually make it through. And I will talk a little bit about that later. There's classically and semi-classically, this seems promising, although a full quantum treatment hasn't been possible so far. Now, an important aspect of the cyclic universe is that it is not the contracting and the expanding phases are not symmetric. So during the contracting phase, the universe contracts very slowly and by a very small total amount. Whereas during the expanding phase, we have the standard phases of radiation, matter, and dark energy domination, which make the universe expand usually. So even though you lose most of space in going towards the crunch because of this instability, those small regions that do make it through, you can show that if you have enough dark energy, they amplify the universe to such an extent that the universe is, again, at least as large as it was one cycle ago. So you can make a large habitable universe as long as you have enough dark energy. And in a sense, dark energy stabilizes this instability and acts as a selection principle, selecting those regions which are habitable. And the constraint on dark energy, if you have no additional stabilization mechanism, is that you should have at least 60 e-folds. So at the current rate, which is about one e-fold per 10 billion years, this would mean that for the next 600 billion years, we would have dark energy domination. And this is something that we call the Phoenix universe, because in some sense, the universe really almost entirely goes to ashes at each crunch, but you have a tiny seed which makes it through and then grows to become the new big universe.
If the dark energy were here, if there's our region, there's another region where the dark energy is 100 times larger, does that then grow 100 times bigger, and does that dominate?
So I'm going to talk about that right at the end. This depends a little bit on what framework you want to use for dark energy. But if you want to just allow... I'll talk at the end. So the idea is, although let me just say briefly, that if you have much larger dark energy, each cycle lasts much longer also. So you make it bigger, but you also
have to wait.
You don't make habitable universes as often. Let me talk about this at the end. I will address that question. You can also take the point of view that the value of dark energy is somehow fixed by microphysics, although I'm not sure that's a very tenable position. But
that was the last one.
That was the last one, yes.
I didn't quite understand the picture here. What would be the initial condition in the terms of the globule or
So you would need to have a compactification which can incorporate the standard model, of course. I'm not really incorporating particle physics here into this picture.
Okay, but do you have to fine tune the initial momentum or
something
like that?
So here, each cycle again sets up the initial conditions for the next cycle, and in fact, this mechanism sort of selects those regions which end up very close to this ridge. So only those regions which have the right initial conditions will actually make it through to the next cycle. All the ones that don't, you lose them.
And it doesn't matter how fast or slow they get to this next cycle, you eventually wind up and end up with the right
ones. Well, so you have after each cycle, you have a whole spread of possible initial conditions, but then you sort of only the ones which happen to be the right ones get selected and will correspond to the next launch region of the universe.
I just have a simple question. So there are two sets of initial conditions. One is how close to the ridge you are, and the other
yes.
one is that how fast you are moving, right?
Oh, right. Well, once you go back, you have Hubble damping due to the... This happens right after the Big Bang. And then so initially the universe is dominated by the kinetic energy of these scalar fields, which their energy density scales as 1/8 to the 6. But you have radiation, which scales as 1/8 to the 4th, and which will, as the universe expands, will quickly come to dominate. And you have the Hubble friction from this radiation stops the field. And then you have the standard periods of radiation and matter domination, and during the dark energy phase, you start rolling very slowly back. But again, you always have Hubble friction, which causes you to, the field to move very slowly until you get to regions of potential which are steeper and which go to negative values.
So is there inheritance of the property of being close to the ridge? Because if you're a region which is close to where the scalar field is close to the ridge, you go into the hyperbaric phase, you bounce, you come out.
Yes.
And then you expand by from the dark energy. Are you still close to the ridge?
Well, so you it spreads out.
It spreads out,
and then again that region which is close to the ridge gets selected to make it through to the next site. This brings me to the sort of global picture that you have. During each cycle, you have these vast habitable regions, but most of that space won't make it to the subsequent cycle. Only within those vast habitable regions do you have actually small pockets where the initial conditions are just right, where you're again very close to the ridge, so that those regions will become, during the next cycle, will become the large regions. So during each cycle, the global picture looks the same, although it's constantly evolving.
Classically, you can set up the initial conditions so that you end up exactly where you are. But as soon as you have quantum fluctuations...
Well, so the quantum fluctuations will spread this whole
range. Well, it's not even clear as soon as you have quantum fluctuations that you, even if you start with the right initial condition, you will end up with what you want. Is it clear that you're going to have an habitable?
So are you asking, is it possible that your whole range of initial condition is away from the ridge?
No, even if you start exactly at the ridge. Classically, yes. I can believe that you're going to end up exactly where you want. But as soon as you add quantum fluctuations on the top of your solution, there's not going to be any habitable local at the end.
Well, actually, the quantum fluctuations are what will eventually produce the density perturbations in the universe. So they're actually
good. You're going to end up going away from the ridge.
Yes, of course, but you don't have to be exactly on the ridge. There is sort of a range of values that is okay. You need to just make sure that you are in a range that's sufficiently close to the ridge so that you stay in the ekbarotic phase throughout the phase where you. Well, the potential
the wave function is a Gaussian centered on the ridge with some spread produced by quantum mechanics. And so the center of the Gaussian is always on the ridge when you're back on the ridge.
Also, the ekbarotic phase is of a finite duration. Right? So at some point, the potential turns off as you get close to the brink. As you get close to the brain collision, and then you don't have this instability anymore. So you only have this unstable phase for a certain finite amount of time. And so that means that you just have to be within a certain range, within a certain distance from the ridge. You don't have to be exactly on the ridge. You can show that, and then by looking at how unstable this is and comparing this with how the universe grows over the course of one cycle, you get this precisely this condition that you need at least 60 EVs of dark energy domination to be able to, sustain the cycle. So,
of course, in some sense, talking about these extremely large regions, which are much bigger than our current horizon, is more metaphysics than physics. So what one would really like to know is, does this model have any observable predictions? And for that, we need to analyze the sort of the density perturbations that are produced by this model. In order to address this, I need to briefly talk about the motion of the brains close to the collision. So it turns out you can derive a solution in supergravity which fixes the motion of the brains very close to the brain collision, because the potential is unimportant there, and you can derive how they behave. So here is a picture where you have a static background space time, and then the brains move along these colored lines. The green line is the trajectory of the negative tension brain, and the red one of the positive tension brain. in this space, so the physical space-time is really just the space in between the two brains, but this is a useful way of deriving their motion. Very, very close to the brain collision, there's just one special thing that happens, and that is that this background, this fiducial space-time, actually contains a time-like naked singularity. And the negative tension brain approaches this singularity. Now, it turns out that if you have matter on this brain, it won't actually hit the singularity, but it will bounce back before touching the singularity. And this has very important consequences for the perturbation, it turns out. And you can describe the same physics in terms of the four-dimensional effective theory, and there in this scalar field space with the two scalars that I had earlier, phi 1 and phi 2, the solution away from this naked singularity, which now corresponds to this top line here at phi 2 equals 0, is that the solution away from this is just a straight line, but it turns out that the presence of this naked singularity corresponds to having a repulsive potential here and makes the trajectory in field space bend around.
Potential goes to minus infinity for that scalar field as the scalar field goes to 0.
So there's no potential here, really. I mean,
but back in the picture, so this is in the higher dimensional picture.
Yes.
Okay.
So this is just the time very close to the brain collision. This is after the ectopic phase.
Right, but can you still see it either in a four-dimensional picture with scalar fields or in a high-dimensional picture?
Yes, you can do, you have complete correspondence between the two.
So in the lower-dimensional picture with scalar fields, what's the characterization of that singularity?
Well, so here you just get an effective repulsive potential close to this singularity. The singularity is really a boundary in moduli space. From the lower dimensional point.
This is all an effect of the kinetic terms.
It's an effect of the kinetic.
That's all.
Okay.
All the kinetic terms.
So it's some function of phi in front of the kinetic term. Okay.
Which acts as a repulsive
potential.
From
the other thing.
Yeah. Okay. Very good. Thank you.
So,
as I said earlier, if you have a single ekparotic field and you neglect gravity, it looks like it has a scale invariant spectrum of perturbations. Here we have two such fields. But if you look at the difference between the two fields, this is an entropy perturbation, and it's actually a gauge invariant quantity. And because these initial fields had scale invariant spectra, the entropy perturbation also has a scale invariant spectrum. And this is precisely the perturbation in this unstable direction. So it's the instability in the potential that really generates the density perturbations here. So at early times during the ekparotic phase, we generate this scale invariant entropy perturbation. However, this bending of the trajectory close to the big crunch causes the entropy perturbation in some sense to be rotated into a curvature perturbation, which is a perturbation along the trajectory. And so you automatically generate a scale invariant curvature perturbation here before the big crunch. So in the expanding, in the contracting phase. And in that sense, you solve the original problem of the single field ekparotic phase.
The field case is still there, but it's overwhelmed by...
Exactly. Yes, it's still there, which means that the perturbations along the trajectory during the ekparotic phase pick up a blue spectrum. And so the spectrum is... on large scales is considered negligible. And it's the large scales that we're interested in. And you get a superposition of these two effects, but it's on large scales, what really dominates is the scale invariant.
I'm really confused. If the blue spectrum is negligible on large scales, why is it excluded? Why is it a problem?
It's not supported by observations.
But we just don't explain the observations.
The observations show that the initial primordial scalar perturbations must have had a very nearly scale invariant spectrum. That's what the CMB.
But I thought only density perturbations, not.
Right. That's which corresponds to the curvature perturbation.
No, I'm sorry about my ignorance here. So there are oh, sorry. There's the term isocurvature perturbation.
Right. Yes, the entropy perturbation here is an isocurvature perturbation.
Okay.
Those two words are synonymous. Entropy and isocurvature perturbation.
And the curvature perturbation.
And curvature and adiabatic perturbations are also synonymous.
Okay.
But you can turn one into the other.
Yeah.
So that's geometrically, the curvature or adiabatic perturbation is a perturbation along the trajectory,
yes.
And the isocurvature or entropy perturbation is a perturbation transverse to the trajectory.
Thank you. I was mixed up.
Now, there's a very at sort of the level.
Back to the
So this entropy perturbation is now going to be the dominant source of
exactly of the curvature perturbations.
Right. It won't remain entropy.
One more. It
just got converted into curvature.
Yeah, but the thing that's delta S over here.
And the origin is the origin of the density perturbation is from the entropy perturbations,
but at late times it's the curvature which.
Right.
So can you go back one more?
Yep.
So there is a point where actually the two brains touch each other.
Well, that's the collision of the brains.
That's
the
collision of the brains.
Yes.
So that's after that bounce.
Exactly. This bounce occurs here, and then afterwards the brains collide.
Okay. So you have another bounce where the brains collide, and nothing interesting happens there, or so you have the point three as well. So do you have to do something?
The point three is the brain collision.
Yes.
Where.
So these modes get mixed up at that point, don't they? I mean, there is...
Well, they're... Let's put it this way. The currently, the best guess for how to evolve the modes across this would be by analytic continuation very close to this. And that seems to indicate that modes get mixed. However, in the absence of a full quantum treatment of this brain collision, this remains just, I would say, the best current guess for what happens. But perhaps something that will be revised in the future. However, it doesn't really make a difference to this picture if there is some mixing, because in this way we already generate the scale invariant curvature perturbations before.
Now, an interesting feature of these perturbations is that, and which really distinguishes from simple inflationary models, is the non-Gaussianity that you produce. So in simple inflationary models, you have a flat potential, which implies that the inflaton is basically a free field and has very small self-interactions, so that the spectrum you produce is very nearly Gaussian. However, here we have these steep potentials. So automatically and necessarily, the fields are self-interacting and will produce significant non-Gaussianity. Let me just go over what the predictions are. So since I've simply assumed these potentials to be there, and that there is currently no microphysical derivation of them, so the best thing to do is just to expand the potential in terms of coefficients kappa 3 and kappa 4 here, which are expected to be of order 1 in an eventual derivation, and just to see what kind of predictions we get. So I've just scaled the expansion by the Pascal parameter epsilon such that one would expect kappa 3 and kappa 4 to be of order 1. Then you can just calculate what entropy perturbation you produce, and you can expand it as a linear perturbation, which will correspond to the Gaussian part, and then non-Gaussian corrections at second and third order, which are determined by these coefficients S2 and S3, which are just given in terms of the parameters of potential. But then the question is, but this is the entropy perturbation, so we still need to know what happens, what we end up with in the curvature perturbation, because that's what we're going to measure.
You're comparing to simple inflationary models, but if you had multi-field inflationary models,
right.
The same things would happen there, and you could get...
Well, you can, you can extend inflationary models by adding extra fields, adding other features to get... But there is no, first of all, there's no real reason to do this. There's no, from observations, there is current, there's no, well.
But the same spirit, if I say, what does supergravity give me? It typically gives me lots of scalar fields during inflation too.
And sometimes these extra scalar fields can give you a more Gaussian situation.
But it happens that the string inflationary ones tend to give you a non-Gaussianity. So the same mechanism works there, but there's is more of a modulation mechanism, so it's happening kind of much later than inflation rather than during your event, but it's the same kind of a conversion of isocurvature to curvature perturbations that are...
Yeah, you can have a similar effect in inflation. Okay. It's just that here, this is, you are required to have this.
Yeah.
In inflation, you are allowed all, I mean, if you want to play that game, you're allowed all sorts of modifications, so you can get any value you want, but then you're not... It's debatable what you're really predicting.
But if you ask in these ones that are motivated by supergravity or shrinkage, if you ask them what's generic,
yes.
And I would say that the non-Gaussianity is more generic. In the sense that
but do you get generic predictions for the actual values?
Because of the mechanism, it'll be order of one, right? What you would get from modulation mechanism generated perturbations.
Or the one for the nonlinearity parameters.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, well, that's not what you get here.
Yeah, so it'd be different.
That's so yeah, so it's different here.
So here there's no constraint on the size of the parameters that you're putting in. You said the only thing that keeps you staying on the ridge is sort of the length of the dark energy phase, and there's no constraint.
Well, there are some constraints on the steepness in the sense that the steepness determines the spectral index. But that if you start with sort of having two exponential potentials, then the spectral index comes out to be very close to scale invariant, within 2 or 3% of scale invariant. So the natural, it turns out the natural values you get at this model are between about 0.97 and 1.02. So it's shifted very slightly to the blue compared to simple inflationary predictions. And it's completely compatible with current observations. Recently,
Paul Syed and I realized that there is a very simple way of calculating the non-Gaussianity you get in the curvature perturbation starting from what you know about the entropy perturbation. And this has to do with the fact that this you really have two completely separate phases in this scalar field space. We have a trajectory which we have an ekparotic phase over here during which the equation of state is much greater than one. And then afterwards, when this conversion happens around here, we're actually W is very close to one. That you're mostly dominated by the kinetic energy of the scalar field. So these two phases are physically really completely separate, and in some sense, the only thing that the kinetic phase knows about the ekparotic phase is the total entropy perturbation that it has as an initial condition. It doesn't know about the decomposition into linear, second order, third order parts. All it sees is the total entropy perturbation, and so in that sense, the evolution of the total entropy perturbation is very close, can be well approximated by just the evolution of the linear part. And this is easy to calculate, and what you find is that the curvature perturbation is roughly 1/5 times the entropy perturbation that you put in after this conversion process. But the fact that we had this second and third order pieces, and the fact that really all the kinetic phase sees is the total entropy perturbation means that very similar relations should hold at second and third order. You should also just find, roughly speaking, this factor of 1/5. Then if you expand the curvature perturbation in a similar way in terms of a linear Gaussian part plus quadratic and cubic corrections, which are parameterized by these nonlinearity parameter, FNL, which gives determines the bispectrum, and GNL, which determines the trispectrum, then you can immediately estimate what kind of values you should get. And you find that you just get something proportional to these second and third order corrections of the entropy perturbation. So you sort of directly convert the second order entropy correction into a second order curvature correction and same at third order. And it turns out, of course, to know precisely what you're predicting, you need to really solve the equations of motion at third order in perturbation theory. This requires quite a lot of work. This is something that Sébastien Renaud-Patel and I derived last year, and you can derive the equations of motion, you can solve them numerically, and it turns out that the results agree to within a factor of 2 with this very simple estimate. So what do these numbers actually mean? I mean, I've just put up these parameters, but in terms of actual values, what do we expect to see? So epsilon is the fast rho parameter, and is typically something like 50 or so. Whereas kappa 3 and kappa 4 were these parameters in the potential that are introduced in such a way that one would expect them to be of order 1. For epsilon, 50 root epsilon is about 7 times 3 halves is about 10. So you can see that F and L is automatically predicted to be a number of order 1 of either sign times 10. And so you expect F and L to be of order several tens, plus or minus several tens, which is very a nice agreement with current constraints, which say that F and L is about 40 plus or minus 40 at the 2 sigma level. For GNL, the parameter of the tri-spectrum, what you find is that here the prediction is quite interesting because you have this extra term which does not depend on these kappa 3 and kappa 4 parameters, and which actually sets the scale of GNL. So you can see that, well, 100 times minus 2/5 is minus 40 times 50 is minus 2,000. So what you expect is roughly something of order minus a few thousand. That's sort of the central value. And then you can start playing with this value by having non-zero kappa 3 and kappa 4. However, you can see that whatever you have here will be suppressed by these large numbers in the denominators. And so it means that a natural value for GNL will be negative and of order 10 to the 3. And so unless you have very large F and L, you can see that really this... You really have to tune the parameter extremely. You need kappa 4 of order 20, 25 or so in order to actually make GNL close to zero, which would be the inflationary prediction. So then that would, from the point of view of the Ekprothing model, that would look extremely unnatural. Single field, simple inflationary models, yes. But here, what's interesting here is that you get that you have that the value is not centered around zero. So F and L is roughly centered around zero, but G and L is really centered around the value of about minus 2,000 or so, or minus several thousand. And so in that sense, even though we don't have a microscopic derivation of the potential, one can still argue that this gives you an idea of what the predictions are. Also, currently there are really no useful observational constraints on G and L, so it will be very interesting in the next few years to see what will be observed. Yes?
Question: why do you believe that the fast rho parameter is around 50 rather than 500? Or
so this mainly has to do with matching what you see at sort of for the power spectrum.
So is it the amplitude of the power spectrum?
It's slightly more. The power spectrum, the value of what you find for the spectral index, the power spectrum, is determined by epsilon plus corrections if epsilon changes over the course of the Ekprothing phase. So you can find a rough estimate of epsilon, what epsilon should be if you want to be reasonably close to scaling variables.
Okay.
And then that's the value I'm using as input to find out what the prediction should be for higher order correlation functions.
Basically, okay, so if the n turned out to be 0.99, this number rather than point out to be 0.999 or something.
Right, then this would have to be revised. Yes.
Okay.
So basically,
in that sense, yes. If you then, yeah.
Okay.
So I had initially I put up a list of open problems with inflation. So I really should do the
same here for the cyclic model. So let me point out some open problems and what one can do about them. So one issue is that the Ekprothing potential is just put in by hand, and it would be really interesting to see if one can derive this from first principles. And for example, if this structure of having an Ekprothing direction with a transverse tachyonic direction is something that arises naturally. So I think this is clearly a calculation that's feasible. There are some preliminary works from a few years ago that have looked at this, but it would be interesting to really pursue this in more detail. The main open problem is really the transition from the Big Crunch to the Big Bang. That's the most important open problem, and this is something that the whole model really hinges on that issue. So as I said earlier, classically, the space-time very close to the brain collision is Milne, so that all curvature invariants are small. You just have the M-theory dimension that shrinks to zero, and so whereas all the other dimensions are finite and non-zero. And so it looks, well, the singularity looks much milder than what you initially think the Big Bang singularity should be like. Semi-classically, you can, for example, since this is in M theory, the coupling constant is proportional, is a monotonic function of the distance between the brains. So as the brains collide, the coupling in the corresponding heterotic string theory description goes to zero. And at the brain collision itself, this coupling is zero. So this is another indication that this might be, it might certainly be possible to go through this, this singularity. And you can also look at, for example, membrane states. You expect there to be stretched membranes in between the boundary brains. So you have the boundary brains, but in M theory, you have M2 brains, which you expect to just stretch in between, and you can, and these become light as the brains approach each other. So you might be worried that you might be that, you know, this would give a divergent result in terms of particle production, or that basically that all your approximations are breaking down. One thing that Neil and Malcolm Perry and Paul Steinert showed was that if you look at the equations of motion of these membranes, they're completely well-behaved at the collision. And also that you, in a semi-classical calculation, they showed that you just produce a finite number of these. Of course, you want to produce matter and radiation at the Big Bang, because this is what corresponds to reheating in this model. So it's actually a good thing that you do produce matter, but you don't want to overproduce matter. So the full quantum treatment has been impossible so far, essentially because M theory is not sufficiently understood. But there are ideas for looking at sort of maybe similar things, similar collapses, and using the ADS-CFT correspondence, where the hope is that you can discuss a gravitational collapse by translating into a conformal field theory where you don't have a collapsing background, and where you just have a field theory where one of the fields goes off to a singularity at infinity, but you don't. But this is all on a fixed background. Right? So there is the hope that you can use the ADS-CFT correspondence to actually address a gravitational singularity. This is just very recent work by Krapps, Hertog, and Turok, and well, it will be interesting to see what it leads. Another sort of very loose idea is what Dvalli has been writing about recently, is that the idea that perhaps the if you have many light degrees of freedom, that the effective scale of quantum gravity is really lower than the Planck scale by a factor of 1 over root n, where n is the number of light degrees of freedom that you have. And what this might mean is that, and a consequence of this, or a way in which this is actually derived, is to show that if you have small black holes, they don't Hawking radiate like large black holes. Large black holes radiate into everything, every available species, in a thermal way and in a sort of so-called democratic way. Whereas if you have black holes that are close to this transition to the quantum gravity regime, controlled by unitarity, that the black hole must have a memory of what it was made of. And so that if you have two particles which collide and form a black hole, at an energy scale close to this, the black hole will preferentially decay back into the same particles. So you might imagine that a brain collision could be a whole collection of these mini scattering events, and that when the brains come to within a distance, which is lower than the Planck scale, but at the onset of quantum gravity, that you might get these sort of intermediate black hole states, and that the brains might just bounce back because you have this memory effect of how the brains come in. It's a very imprecise idea at the moment, but it's another indication that perhaps collisions like this might be fine. A final issue is dark energy. In all these models, the value of dark energy is really just put in by hand. And so the question is, what happens if you want to maybe use these models to address the value of dark energy? What happens if you allow dark energy to vary? One thing is, you risk introducing the measurement problem into these models, because as soon as you have whole different values of dark energy that are possible. You introduce sort of ideas of landscapes and things like this. So it's, well, you have to decide whether you want to go down this road or not. If you do, then, so consider, for example, just the idea of having something like the Busek-Polchinski model combined with theory of the cyclic universe. So you have this whole different, well, you have all these, it's an M-theory, so you have all sorts, you have four-form flux, and you can have all sorts of values for the dark energy due to these fluxes. So I just want to point out that, so if you have the cyclic model with a very large value for dark energy, each cycle lasts much longer. However, during each cycle, most of the time you spend during the dark energy phase where you just make empty space and don't really create conditions for life. So, whereas if you have a small value of dark energy, the cycles last much less long. However, we know there's a minimum dark energy that's required for sustained cycling, which is this value of 60 eV. So the dark energy has a minimum allowed value. But the question is, why shouldn't it be bigger? Well, one possible explanation is that if you have any kind of say, if you follow one specific region of space-time and ask what value are you likely to observe, or if you have any other kind of measure where you mainly look, which is essentially time-dependent, this is similar to, for example, the causal patch measure or something like that, then it is preferable to have a small value of dark energy because you will generate the conditions for life many more times, much more often. So you have many more opportunities. This is only really true. This goes back to Lee's question. This is really if you follow one specific region of space-time. And so it's really just saying if you have a measure that's time dependent and neglects the spatial expansion. And in that case, you could imagine that the most likely history of the universe would be if you had some kind of a beginning where you could imagine the brains arising out of some tunneling event, you would start with a very natural high value of the dark energy, but then immediately jump down to something close to the current value. And then this would be the most probable history. And a prediction of this would be that, well, that the current value would correspond precisely to this critical value of 60 eV. I'm just throwing this in as a comment, really. So to conclude, let me just say, well, so I think it's interesting that in string theory, some of these calculations are now possible, and addressing some cosmological issues are now finally possible, and this is a great opportunity that we have. I would also argue that the cyclic model arises quite naturally from string theory, and therefore is clearly worth pursuing in this context. Moreover, there are definite and falsifiable predictions. I didn't talk about gravitational waves, but because the ekprotic phase corresponds to very slow contraction, the scale factor is almost constant, so you're almost in Minkowski space, which immediately means that you don't produce large-scale gravitational waves. So you don't expect to see gravitational waves. However, you do expect to see curvature perturbations with very distinct non-Gaussian features. So it'll be interesting to see what the observations say about this. Moreover, it might be that the two biggest problems, which I think are the measurement problem and the Big Bang problem, it might be that these turn out to be not just problems both for inflation and string theory, and in the context of each of these theories, they just have to be resolved. So this is something that is really worth pursuing. And I think it's, for example, concerning the measurement problem, it would be interesting to look at dynamics and at issues of whether, there's the question of, is the Sitter space really stable? I mean, if the Sitter space wasn't really stable at high energies, then we would, in some sense, solve the measurement problem. But in any case, I think the most important aspect is that we have very high precision experiments coming up in the near future, which will really be able to guide future research. And so it should be fun pursuing this. Thanks.
This philosophy that we calculate the power spectrum and the Gaussian integers before addressing the big Planck's problem. I mean, why do you expect any other things to be that you calculate before the Planck's survive, like the numbers and to be of the same order after?
Well, so, I mean, the scale of these perturbations, the horizon shrinks extremely fast in the exponential phase and in the approach to the Big Crunch. And all the perturbations that I'm talking about here are vastly larger than the horizon close to the Big Crunch. I mean, exponentially larger. So you could argue, there is some hope that on these scales, whatever happens at the bounds will not significantly affect what happens on scales much larger. I mean, the relevant scales to the bounds are so small compared to these perturbations.
But if it's, well, now I'm going to, because h minus 1 is blowing up, right?
The horizon is shrinking. H is blowing up. H minus 1 is going to 0.
Well, at the naive level, if I have a regular bounds,
but they don't
zero.
Have a regular
bounce. It's not a regular.
It's close to infinity, yeah.
Okay, so the hope
yes.
is that.
Michael? Yeah, I must say this is something that confuses me too. So let me try and make the question a little more precise. So in normal inflation, you create some perturbations at very early times.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have your exit from inflation, where the particle production occurs.
Right.
And there's this argument that what the curvature perturbations do is that they shift that in time, that the moment of particle production, without affecting the process that occurs.
Right.
And so then you get a direct conversion of these curvature perturbations into some temperature perturbation.
Mm-hmm.
You actually now, for you, this is really confusing, because your particle production is occurring just at the time when these entropy perturbations are being converted into curvature.
No, it occurs afterwards.
No, afterwards.
It occurs afterwards.
Hold on, I'm sorry. I thought the particle production occurs at the bounds.
Yeah, no, at this bending of the trajectory, which occurs before the bounds. In this picture,
the conversion was before the bounds.
In this picture, the Big Crunch corresponds to going off to minus infinity here.
Oh.
Because a conversion happened before the bounds.
Oh, so where is the.
And the particle production occurs at the bridge collision, which in the scalar field space is off to minus infinity, but you get there in a finite time.
Oh, I'm sorry. So the thing you were talking about with the particle production by membranes, that's an irrelevant effect, because it occurs much earlier than the bulk of the particle production.
No, this will occur here at this bump, at the brain collision.
Yeah.
You can think of it, a different way of thinking about how perturbations arise here is, the quantum fluctuations correspond to slight ripples in the brains. So in some sense, if you include quantum fluctuations, the brains don't collide everywhere exactly at the same time. In some places, the collision will be a bit earlier, so the hot Big Bang starts a bit earlier, and those regions have a little bit more time to expand and cool.
Right. So that's
others are a bit later, and so you make these cold and hot spots.
Right. But you have to convert everything to curvature perturbations before you can make that argument.
Well, that's what this mechanism achieves.
Good. Thank you.
So in this, when you have two fields, and when you converted the entropic perturbations to the curvature perturbations, so I want to understand the assumption here. So you will have two aquariotic kind of potentials. You start with two. And so in that plot, the equation of state is for one of them.
Well, so that you can do a field redefinition in terms of one field which goes along this ridge in the potential and the other field being transverse to it. And the backward evolution is along the ridge, and that's what determines the equation of state.
Okay, so this field redefinition assumes some choice of parameters?
It's just a rotation in field space. You can express everything, of course, in terms of the original fields in a completely equivalent way. It just makes the analysis physically more transparent because in terms of the interpretation of the perturbations, if you want to separate the perturbations in terms of adiabatic and anthropic perturbations, then this is a good field.
So your second field to start with was identified with the volume of the Calabi-Yau.
Mm-hmm.
So does it have the same structure as the attractive potential between the two planes? or is that an assumption?
Well, they both get, the two fields get a potential, which is, so as I said, these fields phi 1 and phi 2 are both redefinitions, are both functions of the two fields, the radion and the volume modulus. So you can, if you want, you can take this potential and convert it back into a potential for those fields.
So I have... Did you finish?
Yeah.
Okay. So I have one question. You didn't mention anything about the amplitude of a perturbation.
Right. So this is determined by how deep the potential goes. And if you want to get perturbations that are compatible with observations, you need to go roughly to the grand unified scale. Or a bit less, but with, this is in fact completely consistent with this Hojala Witten framework, where the grand unified scale is in that.
So you're saying that if the potential is set to 15 GeV, then you get 10 to the minus 5.
Exactly.
Okay, so it's been a long day, and we're gonna use an hour to regenerate regime stuff, and in the meantime, let's thank Jack.